Today we are continuing our message in the book of Revelation. We're going to be preaching on Revelation from now until Easter. And a series that we subtitled The Understandable, Practical, and Important Message of Revelation, as opposed to the encoded, baffling, futile, and irrelevant message of Revelation, I guess. And but we do want you to know these things, that this message of Revelation was written for a purpose. It was written to comfort God's people in His church going through times of tribulation and struggle that had been unprecedented up until then. I want you to know this book was written for a purpose, and I want you to receive that purpose, to be comforted by it, just as the original writers readers were comforted. So let's go to the book of Revelation. And before, as we turn there, as you open up your bulletin, I want to share with you words of an African-American pastor who's gone on to be with the Lord now. His name's Tom Skinner. He grew up in the Bronx. He grew up in Harlem. Grew up in Harlem in New York. And he was talking about his conversion, and he said, whenever I went to Bible school or Sunday school, I always saw pictures of Jesus, and his skin was real white, and his hair was real long, and he just looked real soft and gentle and kind. And I thought to myself, that guy wouldn't make it 10 minutes in my neighborhood. And so I was not interested in him at all. Today we're going to look at a different picture of Jesus. And I dare to say, this is the picture that was actually converted Pastor Skinner. This guy would survive 10 minutes in any neighborhood. Hear the word of the Lord from Revelation chapter 1, beginning with verse 7. Behold, He is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see Him, even those who pierced Him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of Him. Even so, amen. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus and to Smyrna and to Pergamum and to Thyatira and to Sardis and to Philadelphia and to Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword. And his face was like the sun shining in full strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, fear not. I am the first and the last, and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Write therefore the things that you have seen, those that are, and those that are to take place after this. As for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. Thus far, the reading of God's Word. Lee Strobel is an author. He used to write for the Chicago Tribune, and the Lord converted him, and he began to write books on apologetics. And he tells a story in his book, A Case for Faith. He writes the story of him being in the hospital when his daughter, one of his daughters, had been diagnosed with a strange illness, and she'd been rushed to the neonatal intensive care unit. And she was very young, and she was sick, and the doctors had no idea what was wrong with her. They were afraid she was going to die. And they didn't know what it was. And he was an avowed atheist. And as soon as the doctors left the room and told them, after telling him they didn't know what it was, as soon as he was alone, he hit his knees and he began to pray. And he begged the Lord, save my daughter. If you are real God, save my daughter. 2 hours later, the doctors came in baffled. His daughter's fever had left. She was showing no signs of being sick. She was healed. And at the exact same time, Lee Strobel was healed of his Christianity and went right back to being an atheist. Isn't that interesting? It would be years later before he was converted. Isn't that interesting? Someone who doubted everything about Christianity, didn't believe any of it was true, but when his world was shaken, fell to his knees, because at the core of his being, he knew he needed something bigger than him. Where were you 10 years ago today? Or yesterday, I guess. Where were you 10 years ago this Sunday? I can tell you where you weren't. You weren't at a college football game, or an NFL game, or a NASCAR race, or a rock concert, or a festival of any kind. You weren't at any of that stuff because all of them had been canceled. Every one. Do you remember? Do you remember the Sunday after the 9/11 bombings, how we all flocked to church? Because we knew in the midst of tribulation and fear and danger, we knew at the core of our being that we needed something bigger than us. We needed God to protect us. We knew implicitly that when our world was rocked, we need something stable. The book of Revelation tells you, the purpose of the book of Revelation is to tell you that the convictions at the core of your being, the purpose of the book of Revelation is to tell you that what you already believe is true. You already believe that God is there and He is powerful and He is your only hope of security, and Revelation is there to tell you it's true. And the person who is there is big enough. He is strong enough. He can protect you, and He is with you. And that's what I want you to get from this sermon. I want you to see that God is there, and He is big enough, and He is the only thing that matters. And therefore, worship is the only activity that matters. I want you to look where John is. Look at he says this in Revelation 1:9. You see, the popular idea today, the idea that's popular in the American church is that the tribulation, there's going to be trials, yeah, but the great tribulation, the big tribulation, is still a future event. And before that happens, God is going to rescue all the faithful Christians, pull them up into heaven, and they won't have to go through the great tribulation. And I want you to know that I find that line of interpretation questionable. That's not the historic interpretation of the Bible's message about the end times. And in this church, we're very strong in looking not at just myself, not at just our present culture, but at what history has said. How has God led His church? I don't know if you noticed in the bulletin, one of the songs we sang today was 800 years old. There's stability in that. And we need to look at how history has interpreted the Bible. And sometimes when we read the Bible, we see this. The true interpretation is it couldn't possibly be more obvious. The historic interpretation that I find convincing is that when Jesus predicted a great tribulation, He was talking about the utter destruction of Jerusalem that was about to happen. And He was talking about the Roman Empire turning all of its destructive powers, not only upon Jerusalem and on the Jews, but upon Christians. He was talking about that great tribulation. That's why He said to those who surrounded Him, some of you are here who will not pass away. This generation will not pass away until these things come to pass. And that's why John writes for us in verse 9, I, John, your brother and your partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that are in Jesus was on an island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. He's their partner in the tribulation. It's already started. Caesar is trying to destroy the church. Anyone who will not worship Caesar is persecuted. And John, for preaching the gospel, has been put in a prison camp. The tribulation has already started. Why is that important? It's important because I want you to understand this. The Bible is not a book of instructions on how to avoid suffering. It's not. And if it were, it's not working. And I really believe this. I'm going to say this again at the end, but I think there's a reason why we live in a town that is wildly over-Christianized, and yet hardly anybody goes to church. I've read statistics that as many as 50% of Christians, actually I read one that said 70% of Christians in Tulsa don't go to church on Sundays. Why not? Because they're bitter. And they're mad at God. I think there's a lot of people who are mad at God because he has not kept a promise that, in fact, he never made. He has never promised to rapture you out, to pull you out, to keep you safe from ever struggling. He's never promised you that. What he has promised is to be with you in the struggle. That is the purpose of this book, and that's the purpose of this text, that Jesus is with us in the struggle. How does he encourage us? First of all, he encourages us by telling us that the judgment is coming. Specifically, in light of the tribulation, John wants us to know that the judge has come and he is coming back. He wants us to know that all those who are judged by Jesus, who stand under Jesus, who reveal themselves to Jesus, who hear his conviction, all of them die and are brought back to life. And he wants us to know that the church thrives in the furnace. Three things I want you to get from this text. The judge has come and he is coming back. Those who are under his judgment die with conviction, and he restores their life. And that Jesus is with us in the trials. And the first thing is probably going to be the oddest, but I want you to bear with me for a few minutes, okay? What do I mean when I say the judge has come and he's coming back? Well, Revelation 1:7 says, "Behold, he is coming, and with the clouds, he's coming with the clouds." It's coming with the clouds. The cloud is an important image. What does that mean? Does it mean, you know, there's going to be a low pressure system and it's going to be really stormy that day? Excuse me. And so whenever there's lightning and a big storm coming up, it might be any second. No, that's not. I don't think that's what he means. The clouds, if you do kind of a cloud theology and look at it throughout the Bible, it represents the presence of God. How did God lead the children of Israel through that desert? With a cloud. How did he fill the temple, the tabernacle? With the cloud of his presence. The glory cloud. When Jesus was taken up into heaven, he was surrounded with the cloud. When the apostles were up on the mountaintop and they saw Jesus transfigured, how did they see him? They were surrounded with a cloud. And when Jesus comes back, he's bringing the cloud with him. He's bringing God's presence with him. This new kingdom is going to be a kingdom that is filled with the presence of God. That's how he's going to come back. So what do I mean by saying he's already come? Okay. If you grew up kind of hearing this week after week, you're not going to believe me right now, but that's okay. Just give me a fair hearing and just kind of meditate on it, and we'll work through this as we go through this book of Revelation, okay? A large portion, if not all, of the prophecies of the book of Daniel have already been fulfilled. We're kind of looking in the newspaper to see when God's going to complete prophecies that have been completed thousands of years ago, okay? And this is one of them. Daniel sees in his vision, he's in a time, again, when the people of God are being persecuted. They're under Persia, And Daniel sees a vision of the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And we immediately read into that the second coming of Christ. Here it is. Behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. But where did he come? What direction was he traveling? He came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. He wasn't coming to the earth. The Son of Man was traveling on a cloud to the Ancient of Days. Now, let me ask you something. Does that sound familiar? Jesus told the chief priest that prophecy would be fulfilled in his lifetime and he would see it. The chief priest said, is what they're saying of you true? And he says, yes, I am the Son of Man, and you will see the Son of Man coming on clouds. So when did it happen? It happened in Acts chapter 1. Remember? Acts 1:9. Jesus was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. What does Daniel see? He sees one like the Son of Man going to the Ancient of Days, and he sees a new kingdom established. A new kingdom. It's a small kingdom. It's not great and powerful like the kingdoms of Persia. He calls it a little horn, a little stone. But that little stone hits the great mountain of the kingdoms of the world, and they all crumble, and that one grows into the greatest of all kingdoms. When does John say, what does John say he is? I'm your partner in the tribulation and in the kingdom. What happens when Jesus goes back up to God on the clouds? His kingdom is established. That was the beginning of it. That was the beginning. And we see 2,000 years later that that small, pathetic little stone of a kingdom that had like 12 fishermen, and they were kind of silly, and they started preaching the gospel, and that stone of a kingdom has grown so that right now, all over this world, millions and millions of believers are gathered to worship the King in that kingdom. His stone is growing. That's what's happening. That's who the judge is. And we are told to expect another coming. The judge is coming. He's going to come back. He's going to come back with the glory of God. He's going to come back with the presence of God. He is going to come back. And the question we're left with is, when Jesus gets back, what's he going to be like? What's he going to do? Is he going to be angry? Is he going to bring his sword? Is he going to slay his enemies? Or is he going to be gracious and so happy to see us and gather us to himself like a hen would gather her chicks? And the answer is, yeah. The answer is yes, he is. He's going to be angry, and he's going to gather us. As a matter of fact, the answer is he's already gathering us. And we're going to see this in a few weeks. In Revelation, he sends his messengers out to the four corners of the earth to gather his people. That's what he is doing right now. That's our job. And he's going to come in judgment. And he's very precise about this. That is his job. Our job is to gather his people. His job is to judge his enemies. And that's an important thing that we don't talk about enough. And it's important because, for two reasons. One is this. You will never be able to live a life of anything but just bitterness and disappointment if you don't believe Jesus is going to return to judge the wicked. Because if he doesn't, then the evil get away with it. And that's not a real easy way to live. It's not easy to live a life where people have disappointed you and betrayed you and done evil things to you and they got away with it. And Jesus is telling us, and John is telling us in Revelation, nobody's getting away with anything. God will judge, and he is coming back, and he has seen everything. He's heard every word. He has noted every action, and he is coming back to judge justly. And nobody is getting away with anything. And honestly, that may not sound like it. If no one's ever done anything bad to you, that may not sound like it has a powerful healing message. But if you've ever been really hurt, you know that just injustice, it just grates at your soul. And if God exists, He better make things right. He better judge truly, or what good is He? And the truth is, He's going to. No one gets away with anything. And secondly, He is coming to gather His people. I'm sorry, the second reason why that's important is this. Because as we see the judge coming, it makes us look at ourselves. And it makes us ask ourselves this question, am I ready to see the judge? Every word I've ever said has been noted. Everything I've ever done has been written down. Am I ready to see the judge? And John gets us ready for that by showing us the next verse. What does he say? He says, the hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire, his feet like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. And his face was like the sun shining in full strength. All right, we're going to delve into our first experience here of interpreting the images of Revelation. And I want to start with a phrase I learned yesterday from Phineas and Ferb. Okay, my son was watching Phineas and Ferb yesterday, and they have this character from India, a little Indian boy. What's his name? Baljeet. And they're trying to encourage Baljeet to get in this race and do a bicycle race. And he doesn't want to do a bicycle race because all of his ancestors who've done bicycle races have all ended up getting mauled by tigers. And he doesn't want to do a bicycle race. And so to inspire him, they bring in Greg LeMond, the first American to ever win the Tour de France. And so Greg LeMond is there, and he's trying to inspire Baljeet. And he says to Baljeet, you can do whatever you want. Anything you set your mind to, you can do. And Baljeet said, well, that's not true. I can't fly. I can't put my foot in my mouth. There's a lot of things I can't do. But it's obvious you're speaking hyperbolically, so I'll take the lesson from you and go. Okay, we need, as we go into the book of Revelation, we need to at least be as intelligent as Baljeet. Okay? Jesus doesn't really have a sword for a tongue. Okay? That's good. It would be hard for him to speak, and we would be afraid of him. We're going to go into the book of Revelation going, these are images. They have purpose. We're going to get the purpose. We're not going to try to track down every detail of it. And just like Jesus doesn't really have a sword for a tongue, in several weeks we'll see that, you know, 666 isn't really a tattoo. Okay? These are all images. You get the point of the image and you come away. So what are the points of these images? What does John see? First, he sees great strength. His face is like the sun in full glory. His face is so strong you can't even look on it. His voice is like the rushing of mighty waters. If you've ever stood underneath a waterfall, you've heard that deafening roar. His voice is powerful. His face is powerful. Everything about him is strong. So strong, in fact, that it makes you feel your weakness. Like sitting on the side of an interstate when a truck blows by you and you feel the car shake and you get that shudder down your spine and you know you've just been in the presence of great power and you're afraid. And Jesus appears to John with great purity. His hair is white like wool. His feet are like pure burnished bronze. Everything about him is clean. His feet are clean. His hair is clean. Everything about him is sparkling and clean and pure. And to see his purity is to feel dirty. Back in the early 90s, Jodie Foster was in this movie called Nell. And Nell is a girl who grew up in the woods, and the only human she had any interaction with was her mother. And her mother's actually died, and they've come, and they found her, and she's utterly and perfectly innocent in this story. And they bring her into the city to kind of try to decide what they're going to do with her and how they're going to take care of her. And she gets lost, which fits the purpose of the book. And she walks into a bar, and of course, you know, all the guys in the bar are kind of crass and coarse. And they start kind of messing with her, and she's mimicking everything they do. And so one guy realizes that she's doing whatever they do, so he just takes his shirt off. And so, of course, she just takes her shirt off. And she's standing in front of them naked. And the bar gets completely quiet. And all those men feel their shame. Looking upon her purity, they feel their shame and they slink away. That's what it is to see Jesus, is to feel your dirtiness. We think we're pretty good, don't we? You think you're pretty good? I mean, we all can find worse people out there to compare ourselves to. No matter how much you're cheating, you can find somebody who's cheating more. No matter how much you're drinking, you know people who drink more. No matter how sexually immoral you are, you know people who are worse. We can all find ourselves somebody else out there who's worse. Well, at least I'm not like those self-righteous hypocrites who go to church. We can all find somebody to make ourselves feel good about ourselves, you know? Somebody's out there is so bad that I can't even feel good about me. But when we look at Jesus, we realize that all those other people do not matter. Are you pure compared to Him? And when you see Him, you feel dirty. And then He opens His mouth and John sees this double-edged sword, the symbol of judgment. It's still the symbol of judgment today. If you go to the Supreme Court, you see the friezes up on the walls, and over again, you see people carrying swords. The symbol of judgment. The words of Jesus are coming out to judge. And when he sees that sword, he falls on his face as though dead because he feels caught. You know that feeling in your stomach when there's no hiding. And I used to be a campus minister at Delta State University in Mississippi, and they had a golf course, and the university golf course it just didn't have a lot of money. It's hard to have a golf course in the Delta. If you're listening on tape, I'm not saying anything bad about the Delta, okay? But it's just flat, and it's not very attractive, and they got a grant of $50,000, and they decided to spend the whole grant on one green. And so they built this beautiful green right next to the highway. So when you drive by, you see that green and go, that's a nice course. And it's just about 20 yards short of the highway. It's beautiful. It's hilly, which is why it cost so much money, because they had to bring in the dirt from somewhere else. And they made mounds. And I was playing the golf course, and I was coming up to that hill, that green right next to the highway. And I was about 60 yards out, and I took out my sand wedge, and I came down the ball, and I put just a great amount of top spin on the ball. And it went high, and it landed soft on that beautiful green, and it spun backwards to about 6 inches of the hole in my mind. That's what it was supposed to do. What actually happened was I came down the ball, and for those of you who don't know anything about golf, I did something called blading the ball, which is where instead of getting the blade up under the ball and lifting it high, you hit the golf ball right in the middle, and all of the force is just shot straight into the ball, and so it goes about 3 feet off the ground, which is just high enough to clear that green, and it just scalds for what feels like miles. And so the golf ball just took off, wow, and it goes over the green without even thinking about hitting the ground, just shoo! And behind the green was a real pretty wrought iron fence with brick posts, and it went right through those. And behind the post were these huge pin oak trees that were 75 years old, planted during World War I. Enormous, beautiful trees that did not stop my golf ball. And behind the pin oak trees was the highway, and there was a Suburban going down the road, and my ball went right into the door. Wham! And I'm the only person on the course. And it sounds like a cannon shot, and I'm standing out there just like, caught. Just caught. That is the feeling of standing before Jesus and knowing all your excuses, all of your pretty sounding arguments for why you don't believe, they are nothing. They've been pulled down around your ankles and you are caught. That's how John felt, and he fell on his face as though dead, paralyzed. He was caught. And yet he came back to life. Because what happens next is utterly astounding. We have throughout the Bible examples of people meeting God in their glory. We used one for the call to worship today. Isaiah sees the Lord high and lifted up on the throne, and he is undone. He says, "Woe is me, I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips." And what happens after that is an angel takes a coal from the altar and flies to him. Because he's unholy, he's impure, and he can't possibly even listen to God, much less even fathom touching God. But what happened to John? "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he laid his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not. I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive, and forevermore I have the keys of death and Hades.'" Jesus takes the words of God in his mouth, "I am the first and the last," claiming full divinity, and he puts his hand on John's shoulder. The thing that John feared more than anything else, that tongue of judgment, doesn't speak words of condemnation. It speaks words of grace. "Don't be afraid. I have conquered death. I have died for you." When you decided to live apart from God, you were turning away from the authority, but you didn't understand that you were turning away from the very source of life. And the necessary result of trying to live your life without God is death. And Jesus has died for you. He has conquered death. And the necessary result of dishonoring and disobeying a holy and just God is punishment. But Jesus has conquered punishment for you. He has conquered Hades for you. He holds the keys. And the holiness of God disintegrates John, but the grace of God reconstitutes him. Have you known that? I'm not asking you if you know that up here and you've heard that before in Sunday school. I'm asking you if you've experienced that. There's something I've just recently heard about. I didn't know this. I don't know much about cooking. But evidently, they haven't been refining sugar forever. That was kind of a new thing that evidently people in China or India discovered. And when people from the West, when people from Jerusalem, the Israel area, they traveled into those areas and they tasted sugar. Can you imagine going your whole life and never tasting sugar? And they came back and they tried to describe this wonderful stuff, sugar. And people couldn't get it. And they're like, "Well, it's like honey, but not." Okay. So it's not like honey. And they tried to explain it, and people kind of got, okay, it's sweeter than honey, I get it. But when they put it on their tongues, they would go, "Ah, I get it." I'm not asking you if it makes sense to you that God's holy, okay, yada, yada, yada. Have you gotten it? Have you felt it? And have you felt his hand reconstituting you? Have you heard his tongue speaking grace to you? Have you felt it? If you have, then that is what you need for this life in the furnace. The final thing John wants us to see is that the church thrives in the furnace. Where is Jesus? Where is he? "I saw Jesus amidst," I saw one like the Son of Man, "amidst the lampstands." What does Jesus say the lampstands are? They are the church. Now, a lampstand in the temple would have had seven candles on it. And to see one in the midst of seven lampstands surrounded by all those candles, it would have looked like someone in a furnace. And, of course, the words that John uses are almost exact replicas of the words of King Nebuchadnezzar from Daniel. Almost every paragraph in Revelation refers to Daniel. Or alludes to it in some way. And we know in Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar had taken the three faithful Israelite boys and had thrown them into the furnace to punish them for not worshiping him. And when he looked down into the furnace, what did he see? He saw four people walking around in the furnace. And one of them was like the Son of God. You see what God did not do? God did not keep them from getting thrown into the furnace. God went into the furnace with them. Jesus is not going to keep... He's not. I'm sorry to have to labor this point. I feel like I'm the biggest bearer of bad news in the world. But we are tempted to forget. We lose our sanity. If you need evidence that we've lost our sanity, go look at what was going on at Tulsa's football stadium at 2:30 a.m. It's insane. There's no touching of reality there. There's really not. I'm kidding, of course, but I'm not. I mean, that's crazy. That is crazy. We're crazy. There was one day in our recent history when we were not crazy, the day all of us went to worship. But since then, we've lapsed back into our psychosis that what really matters is sports. He crossed a line. Woo! What really matters is shopping. There's a sale at Penny's. What really matters is the lake. What really matters is time alone with my family. All those things are great. Nobody in here loves football more than me, I assure you. All those things are wonderful gifts of God. But when your doctor comes to you with a bad report, or when a policeman knocks on your door with bad news, or when the divorce attorney calls you up out of the blue, are you dying for a football game? Are you going to bow your knee to the day at the lake, to a day at the lake? When you go into the funeral home, are you going to call the football coach to say a few gracious words to comfort you? We need to regain our sanity. God is not going to rapture you out of this world before the tribulation starts. He is not. Don't get mad at him for not keeping a promise that he never made. He is going to be in that furnace with you. And for some of you, that may sound like, "What? Who cares? And what good is he?" I've been in hospital rooms of unbelievers who are dying with hopelessness and no one around. And I've been in hospital rooms of believers surrounded by their friends in the church. And I can tell you, there is a difference. It's different. To have Jesus with you in the furnace is life. Will you live in light of that life? Will you live in light of that life today? Please pray with me.